Scruggs et al. Mr. Scruggs?
Your Honor, it's Edward Robertson for Mr. Scruggs.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't mean to call Mr. Scruggs. Name's coming up. Mr. Counsel for Mr. Scruggs.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The United States Supreme Court in Skilling said these words, and I quote, Section 1346 criminalizes only the bribe and kickback core of the pre-McNally case law. It does not encompass conduct more wide-ranging than paradigmatic bribes and kickbacks. And finally, quote, no other conduct falls within Section 1346. I believe, Your Honors, that most of the people in this room today would agree that had Mr. Scruggs directly appealed his conviction, it would be overturned because the information to which he pled guilty and the factual basis which supports it do not speak to a quid pro quo bribe, a paradigmatic bribe, that thing that is required by Skilling. Now, I say most because the government's brief says that a quid pro quo bribe is actually pled. But Judge Davidson couldn't find it at the district court, and we can't find it, and I hope the government, when it takes my place here, will point the exact words out to you in that information that leads it to say that in its brief. Because if it does say that, we're here wasting your time, and we don't believe we are. We believe that the district court was without jurisdiction to decide this case. We believe that even if you find that the district court had jurisdiction, that cause and prejudice exist. Mr. Scruggs had cause not to appeal, given this court's precedents, which were firm and consistent, and was prejudiced by the fact that he didn't plead guilty. If we go farther down the Bowsley chain.
But defendants all over the country were raising these kinds of claims. I don't understand why it shouldn't have been raised.
Your Honor, they were raising them all over the country, but as Skilling itself says, they were raising them unsuccessfully, that the courts of appeals had unanimously overturned those appeals.
Well, then is that not a conscious determination that it ain't worth it and I'm not going to do it?
It could be, Your Honor, but it also may be consistent with this court's rulings that a frivolous appeal is one in which the case has been clearly decided by this court and shouldn't be appealed to
well,
take up the
I was talking about your response to Judge Smith.
I'm sorry, sir.
I was talking about your response to Judge Smith.
Well, our view is that it was futile, Your Honor.
We've had legions of cases by prisoners, no doubt, some prisoners with counsel, but by prisoners that raised Apprendi errors, you know, out into infinity and raised Booker-type errors out into infinity. I mean, with Supreme Court law, our law just locked down tight. But they raise the issue and they say, you know, we recognize the law forecloses it, but we're preserving it for purpose of appeal. I mean, for years they did it. And long comes Supreme Court and Booker. Lo and behold, all those people that had preserved those, which seemed to be futile issues, you know, they had preserved them. So I'm just saying, you know, we had prisoners that raised them that could have said the same thing you did, but they had no way of knowing they'd ever get any relief, period, on them. But yet they did. And so there were some who didn't raise them for the very reasons you're espousing. They were shot out of luck. So, you know, coming back to the point, I mean, how does this differ from the standpoint of Mr. Scruggs not raising? I mean, it's there.
Well, Your Honor, we can back up and not even get to this point, but let me answer your question very quickly to say that if the court wants to continue to invite those sorts of things to be filed and to clog your docket in hopes of some long unforeseen thing that may come along, that's certainly a policy choice.
Well,
that
it's
the court
not so much of us inviting, you know, frivolous arguments. It's just a matter of counsel are very adept at raising something, noting that it's foreclosed, but simply saying it's preserved for appeal. We don't, you know, it only takes an eyelash to see that, and it doesn't really clog. So I'm not really saying that. I'm just kind of saying to do what you're asking us to do, how do we differentiate from the sea of cases in other criminal circumstances where people have raised issues, albeit that seemingly were foreclosed, but they simply raise them to preserve them, not to try to get a panel to overturn precedent, not to try to construe Supreme Court law. That's what I'm asking. Even if I agreed with you, I mean, how do I write around that to say somehow this is different than that?
Well, in this case, I don't think you even have to, Your Honor, okay, because we have jurisdictional questions that I think need to be addressed directly.
Okay.
And Cotton was decided, as you all know, in 2002. And it has been quoted widely as saying that all defects in indictments are no longer jurisdictional. But since that time, this court in Rosa Ortiz and the 11th Circuit in Peters and some other courts have said, no, really there are two kinds of indictment defects. One is an indictment defect that deals with a technical issue. We left out the amount of drugs that were involved in the sentencing aspect. That's Cotton. Or we left out an Apprendi kind of thing. Cotton says that's a defect that is waived if you don't appeal it. But Peter and Rosa Ortiz from this circuit say, no, if the thing that is charged is not a crime at all, then the court has no jurisdiction. Cotton relies on Lamar, a case written by Justice Holmes that sets out this dichotomy. Is this crime cognizable under the laws of the United States versus is this something over which the court has jurisdiction because the crime charge is in fact constitutional, but reaches the place where there's an error and the court can make a decision as to whether or not to proceed. We think this falls into the former category because this information, after Skilling, could only have stated a crime cognizable under the laws of the United States if it used the words bribe or kickback or words that meant the same thing, or the factual basis included something like that. And we suggest to you, and we spent a lot of the real estate in our reply brief laying out all of the information and the factual basis, that those words just aren't there. Now, what happened in the district court is, and I frankly haven't seen this before in a district court order, Judge Davidson wrote several Fifth Circuit cases state that a defect in a plea is not jurisdictional, and it quotes Andrade, where intervening law has established that a defendant's actions do not constitute a crime, and thus that the defendant is actually innocent of the charged offense. But if you read the quote, even as it's explained subsequently in Rosa Ortiz, what Judge Davidson said is exactly the opposite of what the case says. Here's what Andrade is quoted as saying, a plea of guilty typically waives all non-jurisdictional defects, but where intervening law has established that a defendant's actions do not constitute a crime, and thus the defendant is actually innocent of the charged offense, application of this rule is misplaced.
Wasn't this argument specifically rejected last year in the Zach Scruggs case?
Your Honor, I beg to differ because in Zach Scruggs, Judge Higginbotham's opinion was that the pleading there was that he had committed misprison of a felony and that was a cognizable crime. But this is a different case. This is a pleading of a 1346, a direct 1346 violation. A 1346 violation that does not use the words bribe or kickback is no violation of all. It is not a crime cognizable under the laws of the United States. And so we think this case falls in to what the 11th Circuit said in Peter, what this court alluded to in Rosa Ortiz, of a case in which there is no jurisdiction in the district court because the information does not charge a crime cognizable under the laws of the United States.
Would we be creating a conflict with the First Circuit and United States v. George if we were to credit your argument?
Well, Your Honor, if that conflict exists, it already exists with Peter, in our view. And I have to tell you that I'm not familiar with George. Now, the government's position is basically that we pled honest services violation, but Skilling puts honest services on a different plane almost than any other statute I've ever seen because it says it is unconstitutional to be guilty of something other than bribes or kickbacks. And the way you determine whether the information, as Peter says, states a crime cognizable under the laws of the United States is by looking at the information and the factual basis. That's as far as you have to go. Marcello says you can't come in and rewrite one of these things. That's you all's decision. So if it's not there, it's not there. And Skilling then puts the onus now on whether or not the information itself pled the case under the Constitution.
Let me read you a quote from George that you're not familiar with. Skilling merely clarifies that to convict someone of honest services fraud, a factual showing of bribery or kickbacks is compulsive. And the going on to say that the fact that the charging document does not allege the bribe does not affect subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, Your Honor, Peter would disagree, and I hope you do too. But the truth of the matter is that I think, is trying to put everything under Cotton, and Cotton itself draws a distinction. Because the Supreme Court of the United States expressly says no other conduct falls within 1346. It's not like leaving out the use that came about in the Bailey case, followed by all the Bowsley cases. It's not like that. It's altogether different. And I think the distinction that needs to be drawn is that distinction. Now, we also say that the First Amendment has some implications here. Because whatever you think of this conduct, and nobody thinks much of it, I can assure you that, this was an endorsement of an individual to become a federal district judge. The indictment on its face, forget the information, the indictment on its face says that the quid pro quo, if there was one, was secret access to the judge in return for Trent Lott getting this call from Mr. Scruggs. But the indictment on its face also says this: that secret access began in August of 2005, almost 9 months before the phone call from Trent Lott, and 4 months before there was any opening in the federal district court. So when we are dealing with First Amendment issues, the right to petition the government, the right to speak on political matters, we have to be very careful how we criminalize those. And even if you believe that the First Amendment ought to allow a quid pro quo bribe when there is an endorsement in return for something, that something has to be very specific. It has to be, I will do this if you will do that. And the indictment on itself doesn't charge that. It basically says that the secret access, and these are its words, were in return for the phone call, but the secret access began 6 months before. That's a fact that the government pled. And if we're going to load down the First Amendment with potential criminality, we have to be very careful to make sure, I respectfully suggest, that that is tied very tightly to the act. Each of you knows, because you have become federal judges, that people make phone calls. And as the testimony in this case repeats from Mr. Langston, you can't say no when a judge does asks for this sort of favor, who wants to move up when you have a case pending. But was there a quid pro quo? That's what Skilling requires. And the answer to that is no, and in this First Amendment context, we have to be very, very careful about saying that the right to call a United States senator, even if he is your brother-in-law, has to be protected and can only be criminalized in the event that there is a specific and explicit agreement reached. And there's no evidence of that in this case, Your Honors. So I would respectfully suggest to you that this falls outside of Cotton. It falls under Rosa Ortiz. It is different than George, that I would respectfully suggest has gotten it wrong. It falls under Peter, and that we are left in a circumstance where Mr. Scruggs, who has served 5 years on this sentence, concurrent with another, is now potentially going to be in jail for something that was decriminalized in Skilling. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Norman.
May it please the court, I'm Bob Norman for the government. I want to disagree with counsel opposite very respectfully, starting with his last statements. Skilling did not decriminalize bribery, which is what this case is about. The quid pro quo is the key to the case, in my view, not only because that makes this a paradigmatic bribe that survives Skilling, but also because that takes it outside the protection of the First Amendment. There is no First Amendment right to bribe judges, and it is the quid pro quo that takes it outside the protection of what would otherwise be political speech. I'd like to talk to the court for a few minutes about the charge itself. Counsel opposite is correct that the information does not use the words quid pro quo. And if I were to draft that information again today, post-Skilling, I, of course, would use the words quid pro quo. But this case predates Skilling, and so does Whitfield. And as this court knows, Whitfield, a decision out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, was cited with approval in Skilling. Whitfield and Kemp were two of the cases the Supreme Court used to illustrate what a paradigmatic bribe is. And when you go to the Whitfield decision, you find one of the issues litigated there was the fact that when the court instructed the jury on the elements of the offense, the words quid pro quo were never used. And that was one of the objections on appeal. The Fifth Circuit in Whitfield, noting that the words quid pro quo were never used, said the law requires that the government prove the specific intent to give or receive something of value in exchange for an official act. And skipping a few words, despite the district court's failure to include the actual phrase quid pro quo in the jury charge, in the instant context, the instructions sufficiently conveyed the essential idea of give and take. That is precisely the argument that counsel makes. In the information used in this case, Mr. Scruggs, in his second guilty plea to a judicial bribery, admitted that he and the lawyers on his legal team devised a scheme and artifice to defraud, and in connection with that scheme and artifice, they used the United States mail. 1346, of course, as we all know, indicates that scheme and artifice to defraud includes the depriving another of the intangible right of honest services, which is what is alleged in the information. I'd also like to point out to the court that in the Jacquez Beltran case out of the Fifth Circuit cited in the briefs, the conferred jurisdiction and indictment need only charge an offense against the United States in language similar to that used in the relevant statute. The information parrots the language of 1346 and 1341. It just doesn't use the word quid pro quo, which, as I understand this court's rationale at Whitfield, would be nice, and I certainly would do it post-Skilling, but not required if the essential idea of a give and take is conveyed in that information. Looking at the jurisdictional objections to this case, I don't know where Peters and Meacham stand after Cotton, and I'm sure that at some point this court will tell us, but it is clear that Peters and Meacham deal with offenses that are simply not violations of federal law. And as the court said in Peters, no amount of proof would help. In that case, it makes sense that if no amount of proof would help, then it probably doesn't need to be before the court. It doesn't need to convey subject matter jurisdiction. But Cotton, the United States Supreme Court says, an indictment or an information may not be artful, as perhaps mine wasn't in light of Skilling. But if it conveys the violation of federal law, then jurisdiction rests in the court. And then all we're arguing about is whether or not the facts prove that violation of the law. That's what the defendant defaulted when he didn't appeal, prosecute a direct appeal on the case. And so after Skilling, wanting to avail himself of the decision in Skilling, he's faced with Bowsley and proving actual innocence. Cause absolutely would not work. As Justice Scalia said in his dissent in Sorich, all of the circuits for two decades have grappled with this issue, trying to cabin the breadth of the honest services fraud statute. Every criminal lawyer knew that. It's not a surprise. And Skilling didn't change the law. Skilling didn't find the statute unconstitutional. Skilling simply drew 1346 into its core offenses of paradigmatic bribes and kickbacks. It's not a sea change in the law. Therefore, any defects in the indictment or information in this case, I submit, fall within the ambit of Cotton and are waived by a defendant who does not prosecute a direct appeal. Jurisdiction vests in the court. There are those who believe, because we are all so accustomed to the presumption of innocence, there are those who believe that Bowsley is unfair. And I'd like to just very quickly address that. It is, of course, Supreme Court precedence, but we're all concerned with fairness. When you look at Schlupp, predating Bowsley, you see the very same requirement placed on a defendant who defaulted on an issue that he then wanted to pursue by habeas. That was a death row inmate bringing that case before the court. And even there, it was fair to make him prove his actual innocence. Our district court judge conducted a two-day hearing because he enlarged the record under Rule 7, because he took into account the guilty pleas of Joey Langston and Steve Patterson, the former state auditor. He allowed the defense a two-day hearing to prove actual innocence. And he found that, as a matter of fact, the defendant wholly failed to prove his innocence. In coming to that conclusion, he also found the testimony of Steve Patterson to not be credible, and he found the testimony of Joey Langston to not be credible. The evidence of a quid pro quo, which I've suggested to the court, is critical here. It takes many forms. But I think perhaps some of the most powerful illustrations are the testimony of Kim Balducci that in the spring of 2006, and this case had been going on for 10 years, but was about to come to its conclusion in the summer of 2006. In the spring, he recalled a conversation at the airport where Ed Peters complained that Judge DeLotta felt that he had kept his end of the bargain, but that it appeared Dickie Scruggs was not keeping his end of the bargain because one of the six federal judgeships open in the Southern District during this period of time had just been filled and he didn't get it. Peters indicated that DeLotta was upset. He felt like he's keeping his end of the bargain, Scruggs wasn't. It was shortly after that that Bobby DeLotta got the call from Senator Lott. And although Senator Lott testified that he never indicated to Bobby DeLotta that he was being considered for a federal judgeship, and although he said it was just a courtesy call, he apparently did not tell Bobby DeLotta, and I don't mean to be facetious by this, but simply to make a point, he didn't tell Bobby DeLotta he was just joking, because Bobby DeLotta wrote a letter the next day to the senator thanking him, gushing about how honored he was to be considered for a federal judgeship, forwarding his resume and asking what, if any, additional information he could provide to speed the process along, or words to that effect. It created in the mind of Bobby DeLotta, that call created in the mind of Bobby DeLotta exactly what the defense wanted it to accomplish. It made Bobby DeLotta feel that this was his last best chance to become a federal judge, something that he wanted more than anything else in the world. And he was willing to sell his soul to get it. And that's what he did. He sold his soul. He was a distinguished jurist, a distinguished prosecutor and judge, but he sold his soul in his quest to become a federal judge. He not only granted secret access to the court, and this, of course, is by virtue of the $1 million paid to Ed Peters to influence his best friend, but he also entered specific rulings that, while not violating the law, shaded findings of fact to give Mr. Scruggs the victory that he wanted. It would do no good to have the judge violate the law because it would be reversed on appeal. What Team Scruggs wanted was for the judge to shade his factual findings, and that's exactly what he did in the quantification order. And that quantification order probably illustrates a lot about the case, because when it was filed initially by Wilson, Team Scruggs, Balducci in particular, felt that it was objectionable, that it invaded the province of the jury because it asked the court to determine the damages in the case. And so Team Scruggs contemplated objecting to that quantification order, but they realized it might be an opportunity. They had to know which way the judge would go in order to decide whether to object to it or embrace it. And so, according to Patterson, that's when the reverse contingency fee occurred. That's when Patterson was told that he could make up to $950,000 more after the $50,000 he'd already gotten if this case came in low. And they told him they needed to know what the judge was going to do on the quantification order. How many lawyers wouldn't I like to know this morning what this court's going to do, but that's not the way it works. And for those of us who practice law, we don't get that benefit, but Mr. Scruggs did. Peters found out and let them know verbally at first that they should proceed. They should embrace quantification because it would give them their win. And then he provided an actual last page of the quantification order showing zero additional funds due and owing to Mr. Wilson. And that, of course, had the added benefit of knocking out punitive damages, which could have been extraordinary. At that point, it was a done deal. Wilson didn't know he'd been had, but Team Scruggs knew exactly what to do. They embraced the quantification order. They got exactly the order that Ed Peters told them they would get from Judge DeLotta, and it saved Mr. Scruggs millions and millions and millions of dollars. Wilson never knew what hit him. And that, Your Honors, is what we're trying to prevent with prosecutions such as this. This has been a long and arduous case for everybody on both sides, but it has implications that reach far beyond this courtroom. It has implications that go to the heart of what we do for a living. And so if it's all right with the court, I'm going to forfeit most of the rest of my time, but I respectfully submit to you that the charge before the court, even if not especially artful in light of Skilling, states an offense. Jurisdiction vested in the court pursuant to Whitfield and Cotton. The defendant failed to prove his actual innocence. The defendant pled guilty to an intentional scheme to defraud a sitting judge. He's trying his best at this point to somehow escape that liability under the rationale in Skilling, but Skilling did not change the honest services fraud statute. Skilling only parried it down to those core offenses, of which this is one. This is a bribery case. There is a paradigmatic bribe. There was a quid pro quo. It wasn't specifically alleged, but it was set forth in the information with enough particularity that one could tell that what was being charged was a thing of value in exchange for an official act. Gentlemen, if it's okay with you, I'll take a seat.
All right. Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Back to the defense, Mr. Roberts.
Please, the court, your honors, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Norman. It was a sea change. Skilling itself says, uniformly, however, the courts of appeals have declined to throw out the statute as irremediably vague. Uniformly, every court of appeals that had looked at it had not reached the conclusion that the United States Supreme Court did. Mr. Norman just spent an enormous amount of time talking about an ethical violation, and my goodness, it was an ethical violation. But at no point did he tell you where in the information or the factual basis was there a quid pro quo. Now, in his brief, on page 14, he says, I pled that. He just stood before you and said that wasn't correct, that I didn't plead it. And Peter says this, if everything that is in the information is proved to the nth degree, is it a crime? And the answer here is no, because of Skilling. Skilling says it's not a crime unless it's a bribe. And it's no different than the United States Supreme Court case in Cleveland, interpreted in Peters, where it was mail fraud to defraud the state of Florida to get an insurance license. And Cleveland comes out and says, no, there has to be property involved, and a license is not property. And Peter says, there's no crime. It's no different than Rosa Ortiz, where a prosecutor who thought it was a terrible idea for somebody to try and break someone out of prison, but the person was in prison because they were there on a witness warrant, a material witness warrant, and they weren't there under a sentence. And this court said, that's not a crime. The statute doesn't criminalize that. And what Mr. Norman is asking you to do is to stand and make the law of this circuit that we don't have to say in an honest services situation what the violation is. He says now that he would do it differently. Well, if he would do it differently now, that is an admission that it's not there back in 2006. And so I would suggest to you that it was a sea change and that it is not a crime. And that's the difference between this case and Cotton. It is an ethical violation. I served for a period of time as a Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court. I know ethical violations, and this is as big as one as you'll ever see. But I will also tell you that absent the interchange of money for the explicit act, given where we are in a political endorsement situation, and when the indictment itself says that the quid has been given 6 months before the quo ever shows up, the pro in that sentence means something. It means something has to be given for something. And if you're giving it away free, you can't do it later. And that's what the indictment on its face says. It was abandoned. The information never even goes that far. And Peter says that's all you have to look at. You know, at the heart of this appeal is not what we do for a living. It's more important than that. At the heart of this appeal is the core concept of liberty, that people are charged with crimes that only the Congress has passed and the courts have jurisdiction over them. At the core of this thing, it goes back clear to the Magna Carta, that we're not going to allow prosecutors to come in and throw you in jail absent telling you that you've committed a crime. And it's not a technical violation here. The laws of the United States include the Constitution, and the Constitution says that absent a bribe or a kickback, there is no crime. These things are enshrined at the founding of this nation, and the principle limits the power of prosecutors and even the courts. And it's the very first thing that Section 2255 says. Habeas corpus is proper when the court that issued the sentence did not have jurisdiction. I appreciate the court's time and its careful consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the argument from both sides in the briefing. The case will be submitted.